and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. Here in mid-August of 2022, the global carbon dioxide level is 417.92 parts per million, and there are 2,703 days left until the year 2030. The clock keeps ticking. Well, recently we had a very interesting conversation with Urvashi Bhatnagar, who is the author of a book called The Sustainability Scorecard, which is a template, literally a scorecard, I guess, that's right there in the title, to help corporations improve their approach to sustainability, which, of course, has enormous implications left and right between your supply chain, how you design things, how you dispose of things, how you think about sustainability. And the book makes the argument that, in fact, that is a profitable thing to do. That is the path to go down if you're running a corporation, because long term, you got to be sustainable. Of course, questions like that spill out, right? For such a simple man, the questions come and say, "Am I good? Where do corporations fit generally? Is that a model that says corporations will save us from climate change if they all get on the sustainability effort?" So in order to sort of think about some of those more philosophical questions, we are thrilled to have back with us Urvashi Bhatnagar, co-author with Paul Anastas of the Sustainability Scorecard. So Urvashi, welcome back to the Climate Minute. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thank you for having me back.
It's great. So tell me, remind me about the book. So we did a podcast, there's a podcast we'll link to, where we talked about the book in some detail, but give me the scope of what you were trying to accomplish, of course, with sort of an eye towards how does it work in the bigger world, right?
Yeah.
So tell me, what do you think?
So yes, how we envision the scorecard working is that we hope it serves as a common language for executives, CEOs, and firms to move beyond compliance and really start reporting, tracking, and actioning on the broader opportunity for sustainability within their organizations. And so that takes the form of your product innovation and process innovation. You captured a lot of it in your introduction, whether it's your supply chain, marketing. I mean, sustainability has implications for just about every part of an organization that one can think of. And so we really get into how to redesign our departments, and then going further from a department perspective all the way up to an organizational perspective, and hopefully an industrial perspective on that. And leveraging the scorecard, we often hear from CEOs or business leaders and innovators that, look, we understand sustainability is important. We do recognize that our natural resources are not infinite. However, this is a very complicated issue. I don't understand where I should place my, where's my first bet going to be, if you will, and how will I measure the ROI? And how also do I ensure that this is going to move the needle, not only just in terms of finances, but also actually provide, more profit along the second and the third bottom line. And so that's a lot of what we go into. We try to get into some of the scientific top line items that we recommend belong in this scorecard, this high-level scorecard. And the hope is that leaders will drill down into it and they'll say, okay, I'm tracking bioaccumulation, I'm tracking bioavailability, I'm tracking all of these things. These are things that usually are way down somewhere, in your supply chain, probably right. Not even, but we hope that these get brought up so that we're going beyond just what is the number of sick days and things like that are in place.
I mean, I think it flashed as you were speaking. I mean, in a sense, the book is to help people corporations get beyond mere compliance, right? And truly take on this whole thing and say, you know, we're not just going to meet the minimum, right? We want to do it right because we see an opportunity there. So I guess that begs then the question is, how do you think, what's the impetus for a CEO to take on that challenge? I mean, is it bottom line, we're all going to make more money, right? Is that the sole thing, or is there more to it?
Yeah. So definitely there's more to it. When we think about what will awaken CEOs to adopting this scorecard, I think the business case for the why is closed. And there are a lot of indicators that in the industry that will show us that. For example, ESG auditing and compliance and things like that demonstrates that.
ESG auditing. What does that term mean? Just remind our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. So auditing, formally auditing and reporting on the firm's environmental, social, and governance factors, and making sure that we have the appropriate disclosures in our reporting, whether we are, you know, creating disclosures that provide appropriate information to our consumers and audience, or whether you're disclosing things to the SEC. It is clear from a compliance standpoint that the government requires this information. They expect this information to be provided by firms, and consumers expect a basic level of adherence to environmental social governance standards.
And is that yet part of sort of SEC's, the Security and Exchange Commission filings in quotation mark, which means the stuff that a corporation publicly has to tell the government? Is that involved in is the ESG stuff part of that yet, or are we still moving towards that?
I believe it is a requirement, and there is going to be auditing along this. Mm-hmm. I am personally unclear when that deadline is and when it starts.
Right.
I'm
right.
certain there's some kind of a ramp to right. that. Right. I'll have to look that up. I'm not a accounting professional or a lawyer.
It's funny when you're talking about doing the audits, all I can think of is the joke about the accountant, where the interviewing for the job and the CEO says, you know, what's 1 + 1? And the accountant says, well, what do you want it to be? And that's the answer. Right? The same thing may hold true for auditing ESG stuff, right? So the question is, what's the ultimate framework that we arrive at that gives discipline and consistency across different corporations? I suppose that's a long-term project, right, to arrive at.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
exactly. And I believe, and I remember this because it came out in my birthday month of April. I believe this was in 2020 that the AICPA published a big article in their monthly magazine on the triple bottom line and how the accounting industry was preparing for a future where such audits would have to be standardized, reporting would have to be standardized, and some kind of minimum baseline would have to be created so that they could, you know, sort of benchmark firms
And just remind again, the other remind listeners, the triple bottom line means some sense of value or profit in environmental sustainability and corporate governance. Is those the three categories that you're making the case that you've added value to the universe, right? The corporation has.
Right. So the first bottom line, so if you're thinking about, you know, your balance sheet, the first bottom line is your financial profits. And that's actually something that Milton Friedman talks about, is he talks about maximizing profits. So the importance of the first bottom line is undeniable. It's how we are, you know, economically deriving value every day. So that's the first bottom line, is financial, and we're all very used to reporting on that. The second one is social, and then environmental. And so within social, there has been much action in the past. You'll find firms that think of ESG in terms of corporate responsibility, or firms that think of ESG as just a part of business as usual, and, you know, as a measure of innovation, corporate strategy, they all adopt the triple bottom line, market leading firms. But currently, sort of that formal reporting hasn't been done. A lot of this information goes into their sustainability reports. That's where we're used to seeing it.
But the triple bottom line sort of nomenclature is a way to think about these issues, and quantification is difficult, but it's so. Would it take a law? So then the question comes as to back to what makes the CEO, you know, salute and say, we're going to do this. Would it be that the SEC formalizes, the Securities and Exchange Commission formalizes this sort of triple bottom line concept, and that they are required, the corporation is required to report on this? Is that, I mean, back to sort of the core question, it's like, how do we get corporations to join the cause?
Yeah. Let me address the how do we get corporations to join the cause part a little bit more broadly. So I think compliance is a very strong lever for joining the cause. And that's certainly something that is in progress. There is a deadline. There is action towards the same. You have large organizations that are working to ensure this compliance with industry firms, external auditors that are working every day to figure this out, what that standardization is going to be and how they're going to report on it. However, I think once, if we're thinking about going beyond, so once everyone has joined the cause, which they will, whether they like it or not, right? There are going to be firms that lead the market, and there are going to be others that begrudgingly adopt this and keep moving along. And so I would like to broaden my response from joining the club to more who's going to be the winner and how is the economy going to reshape. And I think it is firmly going to be, when you think about the next 50 to 100 years and the world that our children are going to work in, I think there will be innovation along the triple bottom line. I think it's the case for why will be closed. The case for compliance will be kind of like the DMV, where, you know, this is a check that everybody must do. It's incredibly important, but it's done. And then the question becomes, what next? And they already, if you look at Gen Z, they already recognize that this is a vast opportunity for innovation. There are startups, there's a lot of work in large organizations to transform themselves so that they're relevant for the next generation. And that, I think, that is where the innovation lies, to transform yourself so that you are leveraging the opportunities provided by this climate change economic shock. You're leveraging the opportunities that are within the line items of the second and the third bottom line to innovate your existing processes and products.
How do you, I come back to the question of the triple bottom line, only one of those, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, only one of the three, the quarterly profit, that pays, puts food on the table, right? The other things are nice, but they're not, what's the word, tangible or fungible or something, right? You can't do anything with it, right? So is not the other two legs of the other two triple bottom line, aren't they always going to follow the profit thing because that's what people want? Right. How do you, I give a question the other way, is how do you make the other aspects of the triple bottom line as important as the financial one?
Yeah, I think the market is doing that. When you look at some industries like consumer goods, retail, cosmetics, I mean, anything where there is direct contact with consumers, you see this very strong lever within their innovation where the consumers are saying, look, I want more sustainable products, and these firms cannot create the next it chemical fast enough, rather. So I mean, consumers are very savvy. You go onto YouTube, you'll find gazillions of videos on clean makeup. And I mean, the demand is just currently unmet, right? Mm-hmm. So there are many, many industry sectors where a lever like this is extremely important. And that I would say is important from a quarterly basis, especially when you have industries where like the margins might be very thin because the products are so fast moving, that margins are thin, profits, there's a lot of investment in R&D and it has to be very quickly converted into profits. In others, there isn't so much of a focus on this. And one of those is, for example, mine, healthcare. We are still at the point where consumers are still trying, or patients are still trying to understand, hey, when is the billing cycle complete? When am I going to get my bill? We are not yet at the point where we start asking, what are the side effects of my anesthesia? Is there a green anesthesia option where, you know, there's less of an impact to the surrounding environment? Nothing goes into the air quality, yet I still receive the performance.
The case you're making is then that corporations that have the opportunity, and I'm throwing around a bunch of words I don't really know, but I mean, the social license, the valuation of a company based on its appreciation in the marketplace. I guess I'm thinking, what's the company? Patagonia, right? I mean, they market themselves as someone. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about? That people respond to that, and so the financial valuation of the company scales with the other bottom lines that they have.
Yeah, something like that. So you have Patagonia, you have, cosmetics firms, retail firms, the agriculture industry, very connected to land use and things like that, where all of these are very important factors. And as that reporting comes in, it's going to be apparent, we're going to see a very quick uptick, in how, you know, we'll see a clear demonstration of how maybe there were profits, but it didn't meet consumer satisfaction, or it's not yet keeping pace with innovation.
But so I guess just following, if you're, take a company like Patagonia, which I don't really know that well, but I mean, certainly Exxon, they daily on TV tell us about how they're making green algae to power the future. It's green. It's complete hogwash, right? But they are working. Maybe that proves your point, is that even a company like Exxon recognizes there's value in being well respected in a world of honest communications. That would be a good thing, right? That's the case you're making.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's not just Exxon. If you think about BP was first British Petroleum, and now they're actually beyond petroleum. Yeah. Ford has rebranded themselves as a mobility company. Who knows what they're going to be doing in the future? Mm-hmm. But they do know that they want to be involved in the mobility space, however the automobile sector transforms itself. Right.
I remember years ago the somebody talking about how the railroad industry thought it was in the railroad industry, and when the trucks came, they didn't realize they were in the transportation industry. So when the trucks came, you know, ate their lunch, right? And that so you're right. But Ford saying I'm in mobility, it's not selling F-150s necessarily, right? It's I'm in this other new business and I'm trying to adapt to that. Yeah.
Exactly. And so actually that brings me back to, I know we discussed this, on email and before our call, where we were thinking of this broader question of, is capitalism the friend or foe of climate survival? And if we want to provide a decent life for 8 to 9 billion people, can we only focus on profits, or are we going to have to expand into equity? I think the key word there were regardless of profitability. And I think that's where the interesting discussion is.
I'm all ears. Please tell me, what do I need to know? Because I think those are incredibly important questions, right?
So my opinion is that, so I, capitalism is certainly a friend of climate survival because capitalism is a friend of innovation. And what the demand is signaling to us is that we need to go into another direction. We need to go away from the assumptions that created the present day economy, which is that our natural resources are limitless and they're going to support our survival forever. However, I think where the interesting discussion is about whether equity is more important than profitability, I think that actually goes back to a very important theory put forth by Milton Friedman, where he mentioned that...
Milton Friedman is an economist from just post-World War II, right? In today's parlance, would be a very conservative kind of guy. He was worried about, you know, individual freedom against Stalin, right? But now that's it, now that is all carried on, right? So Milton Friedman is this guy you can go read many, many books about. I'm so sorry for interrupting. Keep going.
Absolutely. And actually, it's interesting that we're recording this now because I believe the 51st anniversary of his groundbreaking article on his views on economy was actually July. It was in July that he had published that article. I believe it was in the New York Times. Not sure if it was, but anyway.
Years and years ago.
Yes, 51 years ago. And essentially the core tenet of his article or of his beliefs was that a manager or an employee's sole purpose in the workplace is to maximize profit, is to maximize shareholder profit. And any activity that you are doing that does not maximize shareholder profit is basically going against the company. And you're then, quote unquote, not a team player. You're not working towards profitability. And so there's a lot of thoughts on his work and how it's relevant today. People talk about whether, you know, is the triple bottom line just an expansion of his views? And you know, maybe Milton Friedman is still relevant.
It's like Milton Friedman says everything must be devoted to profitability, shareholder profitability. And what that translates into nowadays in sort of very real terms is that corporations are focused on their quarterly profit statement. That's all they, and it translates into, you know, they'll lay everybody off the day before the end of the quarter to get a good quarterly statement, right? And so the sort of almost fetishization, if that's a word, of like the quarterly profits, and we have to make money every quarter, that somehow all rewinds back to the ideas of Milton Friedman. And that's exactly the legacy you're living with, right? So you're better off understanding it.
Yeah. And he mentioned that anything that you're not doing that maximizes profits is essentially philanthropy. So, for example, taxes. That was something that one did for social good. However, when we talk about corporate social responsibility, which is a department that every firm has now, whether we agree with their practices or not is immaterial to this discussion right now. But he actually said that CSR, or corporate social responsibility, is not something that was in line with his view of economics. It is not something that is going to drive or maximize shareholder wealth, and therefore it's not a point up for discussion and it shouldn't exist within an organization.
Which is where Exxon feels free to go march to the North Pole and, you know, drill in the Arctic because, you know, shareholder profit, right? I mean, everything else is just exactly. Philanthropy, as you say. And
right. Well,
Milton Friedman is not my friend. I mean, the question, so what is the, I mean, how do you get around that? I mean, because I think, and I just start to answer my own question. It's like, if you don't agree with Milton Friedman, then all of a sudden you're a socialist, you're a Stalinist, right? And the polarity there is so great. I mean, what's the middle ground? How do we, because, you know, in my own case, I mean, I think, you need some form of capitalism. And I was going to ask you this question. It's like, when you say capitalism, you cover a lot of ground, right? We have this sort of modern corporate capitalism where we're subsidizing Exxon and starving the solar panel industry kind of thing, right? Is that capitalism? And when you say but on the other hand, what's his name? Adam Smith, right? We all go to the market and buy tomatoes and we all can look at every tomato and I mean, that is not reality either. So what, when you say capitalism, what do you mean? And what kind of capitalism are we heading for?
Yeah. So I actually disagree with the notion that if you're not Milton Friedman, then you are not capitalist. I disagree with that. It is not a zero and a one. It's not that if you're not Milton Friedman, you are neoliberal.
Fidel Castro.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's not the view. What I think is true is that capitalism is a very broad term that encompasses basically how do we provide everybody an opportunity to innovate and maximize shareholder wealth is important. However, we also need to maximize the second and the third bottom line. And whether we like it or not, the market is headed that way. People are telling us that they do not want to consume carcinogens with their coffee. That is it. And so the market is going to self-select firms that are providing products and processes that are better for them. It's quite, it is actually in line with the purest form of the definition of capitalism that we read in textbooks, that if you want a product that that is high performing, then do you think product, is it product A or product B? Let's say product A is coffee and it's, you know, wonderful, decaf, has everything you want in it. Product B is coffee, but the way it was made, it during the process of decaffeination, it introduced various carcinogens in your coffee.
Or if, right? I could throw in another thing the corporation is laying off its Starbucks employees to prevent unionization, right? That may also influence your coffee decision that day, right?
Exactly. And so what we're dealing with in the marketplace is something that Milton Friedman, it's my personal opinion that he didn't foresee this. He wrote his theories a very long time ago, and he also based them off of historical trajectory. The Industrial Revolution occurred. There was a lot of innovation. We built the economic systems that we have today, but they were built on assumptions that these natural resources would thrive and live forever, and we'd have constant inputs. We know now that that's not the case, and we have to account for where our raw minerals are coming from and how these products affect our everyday life. And so consumers are choosing today.
Tell me this, how, forgive me for interrupting, but how do you think that theory plays in, there are large swaths of the world, in, you know, Africa, or South America, places where I guess what I'm trying to work my way towards is the idea that capitalism, you know, allows people to create value, right? That needs to be somehow kickstarted with a financial system and legal principles where you can trust each other, right? And there's some way to adjudicate. I mean, so how do you carry that into other parts of the world?
So
God knows. I mean, there's a lot of people that are not part of sort of corporate Western capitalism, right?
Right, right. So I think there's a lot of innovation today, even in the banking space, for example. When you look at blockchain and those kind of solutions, they create a lot of transparency, and it allows you to, you know, whether it's smart contracts or whatever, it creates a greater degree of trust between the buyer and the seller, and allows you to see the supply chain with more detail. So those kind of solutions are definitely taking us into the right direction. But how all of this will play well with one another, and, you know, how certain economic systems in certain countries will merge with others. I mean, this is a globalized world. We all trade with each other. We've all seen the effect of Russia, you know.
Do you think that there's sort of a Stalinism was a command economy. To some extent, China has been, but they're in this sort of funny middle ground between having capitalism and being told what to do. In a world where so many people are in desperate straits, right? And is there a way to tame capitalism in a way that addresses the needs of the majority of the people on the planet, do you think? I mean, that's not an easy question to answer in 140 characters or anything, right? But I mean, how should we be thinking? And I guess my favorite quote that I've said 1,000 times is from Ursula Le Guin, the science fiction writer, who said, if you described capitalism to a medieval peasant in the year 1000, he would not know what the heck you were talking about, right? It would just be so foreign to whatever conception, right? And so it seems like we're heading into something that's going to be new and different and not going to be capitalism because it's unclear if capitalism can satisfy the 8 billion people on the planet. But what's it going to be? It has to be some kind of capitalistic in the sense that you can better yourself. All right, you can work and gain value and control your own. So let me throw that one at you. Tell me, where is this the global economy going to be in 150 years, right?
Oh, gosh. Well, I hope it's far more sustainable. But okay, so one, as it relates to emerging markets and developing economies, I know there's a lot more at play here. And it's impossible for any one person to predict what's going to happen politically in all of these nations. But I think if we stuck to capitalism in its purest definition of creating wealth, fostering innovation, that kind of thing, maximizing value, whatever that value is, emerging markets have the greatest opportunity to have these supply chains now where they, research and development is cheaper in these areas. Cost of living is cheaper. It is the perfect hotbed for innovation. We can derive cleaner, quote unquote, supply chains from those areas and have these nations supply raw minerals or do research on alternative inputs into our products. So I think there's a great opportunity here. And I like to believe, I'm an optimist, and I like to believe that that's the direction in which we're heading. Because when you look at what's going on here in the United States today, or Europe even, as large, if you want to take a large landmass, the direction is going towards the triple bottom line. And so if markets are supporting these very big land masses and consumers within these very big land masses, it shows us that we're going to need greener supply chains, greener products, ultimately. And ultimately, that's the direction in which we're heading. Of course, in certain areas, we have authoritarian governments and, you know, things like that, loose regulation or regulations that are not in line or not supportive of the principles in the West. Waits to be seen what will happen.
Tell me this. I mean, after the Second World War, the Bretton Woods Conference, I think, which I actually went skiing at Bretton Woods up in New Hampshire one time. But in the Bretton Woods Conference, basically laid out the post-World War II financial arrangements, right? And it seems like where you're headed is that there needs to be some other, maybe it's a United Nations agency, there has to be some agreement that places, less developed places are given the money and the opportunity to develop in some more fair way. Because as you were speaking, I was thinking that, you know, the analogy about how a place like China never had to put in telephone lines because they went directly to the cell phone, right? So now they just put up one tower and everybody gets, the same thing is true for developing supply chains. If you start from nothing, you can build it right, in quotation marks, that matches the way the sustainability needs that we have today. So there's great opportunity in these places to do that. But it seems like, again, capitalism And then you head off into a whole other way, colonial capitalism, where all of the resources are taken by places, companies here in the U.S., right? How do we get to a, without some big agreement, and God knows the Paris Accord is weak enough, so it's unlikely you're going to get there. But is an agreement where we all say, yeah, we got to be more fair about the distribution of economic opportunity, such an empty phrase, but is that, so what do you think about that?
Yeah. I would think so. So Bretton Woods, I mean, that was the birthplace of the World Bank and IMF and multilateral institutions as we know them today, right? And I think at the time they served the function that they were intended to. And over the years, some of it has become that they're figureheads. At times, they are effective in leveraging funds so that we can provide bailouts and things like that. But it appears that their function changes over time to suit the needs of the economy, global economy. I think, overall, I'm sure that trade and consumerism will have to be supported by some kind of legislation or some kind of overarching treaty or pact or things like that. But I will say that economic drivers cannot be understated. They're very important. Even when you think about South Africa and overcoming apartheid, there's a very famous Harvard Business Review case on this about how the beer industry was very important in overturning apartheid because business leaders realized that they were going to be the first to lose. And so regardless of whether they agreed with certain policies or not was immaterial, because their focus was on profits and consumers, they had to be the first at the solution. And they changed hiring practices. They created partnerships with beer producers across Africa in other nations and created channels by which to keep that industry alive. And that was a very strong push alongside other many very important factors to overturn apartheid. So what I mean to say is that equity is important. It will always be important. Pacts, treaties, and organizations like the World Bank and IMF, however they innovate themselves to create some kind of policy change between nations, are always going to be important. However, I do think that capitalism in some form or some theory away from Milton Friedman is going to be one of the strongest drivers in driving us towards a more sustainable future, which is, in my opinion, inevitable, because that's where we're heading now. We already have the compliance in place, and whether firms like to believe it or not, they're going to have to innovate along these lines.
Wow. So this conversation has been fascinating. Rashi, tell me again the name of the book, the scorecard book, and how people can find it, where if they wanted to read up on what you've written.
You can go on Amazon and search for the Sustainability Scorecard by Rashi Bhatnagar and Paul Anastas. Uh-huh. So we're on Amazon, Barnes & Noble's. I believe Powell's bookstore in Portland is carrying two of our copies today.
That is great. Well, this topic is so big. And it's so interesting. There's so many aspects to it. I really appreciate your taking the time to dabble in philosophy with a dilettante like myself. I know you study it all the time, and this is great. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat. What we'll do is we'll put up a link to your book, how people can see the book. Maybe I'll try and find out go to Wikipedia and find out what the Bretton Woods conference was, and maybe a biography of our good friend Milton Friedman. And we, because know your enemy, I guess, is a good place to start. But this has been, so we'll do that. And then let me just go through the, hang on. I've got all kinds of stuff to say here. Typically we, so you can find if you have an idea of a show you want us to talk about, send us a suggestion to podcast@massclimateaction.net. You're probably listening to this show on your smartphone. You can tell all your friends to listen to the Climate Minute on their favorite podcast distribution application on their mobile device. We're everywhere. Rashi, I want to thank you for taking the time on this the hot August day to chat about these very very low, maybe up at 30 or 40,000 feet is cooler here. Now where we're flying around now is a little cooler than on the ground. But anyway, this has been a very entertaining conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat.
Thank you so much. So thrilled to be here.
Thanks for everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.